Good morning. Welcome to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. My name is David Baum, and I am the moderator for this morning's program. Since 1828, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is held at the historic Unitarian Universalist Church in downtown Peterborough, New Hampshire at 11 o'clock on Sunday summer mornings. We invite our New Hampshire Public Radio audience to attend these programs and to meet our speakers at the reception following the program. After the talk, I will read questions from our live audience. Our speaker today is Dr. Wesley Wildman. Here's my introduction. A few months ago, my wife and I hosted 9 Tibetan monks for 2 weeks at our home in Peterborough. Their chant master, Jampa, a large and powerful man in presence and form, spoke no English. I speak no Tibetan. We got by with pointing and smiling. One night as he was praying at our house, I thought I recognized in his chant the melody threads of a favorite obscure album. The singer was a little-known Buddhist nun from Bhutan. I played it for him on my iPhone. It turned out to be a version of the song he was singing. Jampa got very excited, ran upstairs, got his cell phone, and proceeded to copy my entire album by holding the two phones next to one another. With his enthusiastic encouragement, together we sang this very esoteric chant. When I say we, I mean Jampa, myself, my iPhone, and his cell phone. It was all very fast and somewhat hard to track, though it was clear something had occurred. 1 week after he left Peterborough, Jampa friended me on Facebook. I am hoping that our speaker today can help explain this to a slightly confused 56-year-old man. Dr. Wesley Wildman is professor of philosophy, theology, and ethics at Boston University and directs the doctoral program in religion and science. He's the author of Religious and Spiritual Experiences from Cambridge University Press and many other books and articles. He works with a variety of researchers to develop new techniques for studying religious and spiritual experiences so as to understand their nature, their neurology, their cognitive reliability, and their meaning in human life. He founded the Institute for the Bioculture Study of Religion and operates scienceonreligion.org and numerous blogs and websites. Please join me in giving a very warm welcome to Dr. Wesley Wildman.
Good morning, everyone. It's lovely for me to be here. Yesterday was the 25th anniversary of my arrival in this fine country, but my accent remains an Australian accent, so I'll have to speak slowly so that you can have half a chance of understanding what I'm saying. From the earliest traces of human history until today, there have been techniques for stimulating spiritual experiences. As our species explored our physical, social, and mental environments, we sometimes came across something really interesting. A special mushroom, a way of dancing around the fire, a meditation technique, all triggers for powerful spiritual experiences. In each of the botanical, psychosocial, and meditative domains, our understanding of how these techniques work has deepened rapidly in the last few decades. The coarse techniques of the past are rapidly becoming refined technologies that promise customized access to spiritual experiences on demand. Every month, new research papers tell us more about the functional and anatomical neurology of many aspects of spiritual experiences, thereby potentially exposing the relevant brain processes to selective inhibition and enhancement. Whether we welcome it or fear it, the era in which we can induce, suppress, and control many spiritual experiences is fast approaching. Capacities for control that once came to us only in dreams and nightmares, in science fiction and fantasy, will in short order be familiar aspects of life. This presents major ethical quandaries. In this lecture, I want to explore these technologies and the associated ethical puzzles. I'm going to start with techniques familiar from the past as they're being transformed in the present and will be in the future, and then move on to techniques that are brand new. In the process, I'm going to be speaking about the future, making predictions. At the beautiful bed and breakfast where we're staying, the little river bed and breakfast here in Peterborough, the conversation over breakfast this morning turned on people who can get away with saying things and are never held accountable for what they say. They might have been thinking of politicians or something. But I thought of myself making predictions about the future this morning, for which perhaps no one will ever hold me accountable. So after that beautiful bed and breakfast conversation, I decided that if none of the predictions I make this morning come true within 30 years from now, that I will make a $1,000 donation to some very worthy cause as a form of repentance. And the only caveat is that we have to have a continuing of our civilization without any serious collapse. Because if there's a collapse of civilization, obviously we'll be in survival mode and none of these things will be possible anyway. So, all right, familiar technologies hurtling into the future. Let's start there. Human beings and other animals get drunk from fermented fruit. Some foods are poisonous. Brackish water makes us ill. When there is any confusion about the effects of food, we can compare reports and use trial and error to find out which food does what. Our sense of taste guides us to foods that contain all-important glucose, but it also draws us to explore the marvelous aesthetic world of tastes. Our enjoyment of food leads us to explore more widely in search of foods with special powers that are more important to us than how pleasant things taste. All species explore their botanical environment for food. We just do it in a more systematic, more experimental way. Long ago in the uncharted past, human beings discovered foods that induced altered states of consciousness, replete with spiritual significance. These foods are known as entheogens, as are the naturally occurring or artificially prepared substances that have similar spiritually potent psychoactive properties. The botanicals producing these effects were recorded in the oral lore of medical and shamanic traditions and passed down the generations. Corporate rituals often developed around plants with psychoactive properties. Medical anthropologists and ethnobotanists have identified hundreds of plants believed by ancient cultures to have mind-altering effects. Here are several well-known examples. First, the peyote cactus has been used for millennia in medicinal and ritual practices among people native to the southwest of the North American continent. This plant is best known for its spiritual use within the so-called Native American Church, which has been the subject of protracted legal battles over its religious ritual involving a brew made from the peyote cactus buttons. Second, the fungi psilocybin mushroom also has a multi-millennia history. It was made famous in recent times by Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, who founded Harvard University's psilocybin project in 1960. The formal research project ended within a couple of years, and the two men were fired from the university in 1963 after a highly public scandal and aborted state of investigation. Third, ayahuasca is a vine widespread in the Amazonian rainforests. By itself, it is not psychoactive, because the human digestive system breaks down the psychoactive chemicals too quickly. But when combined with certain other plants, the breakdown of ayahuasca's psychoactive ingredients is inhibited, and the resulting brew can be extremely potent. Many other plants have similar properties, including some acacia trees that you find in the Middle East. Several contemporary religious groups use one or another form of an ayahuasca brew in religious rituals, including Santa Daime, which integrates shamanistic elements with Christianity. Santa Daime was founded by Mestre Irineu in Brazil in the first half of the 20th century. It's since spread with Brazilians to many parts of the world, including to Boston and New England. Their usage of ayahuasca in religious rituals has been the subject of many court rulings in the last two decades. You're not allowed to use the chemical, but you are allowed to use the plant. That's where the courts came down on it. The difference between the past and the future in regard to these botanicals is the scientific discovery of which chemicals within those plants are primarily responsible for the entheogenic effects. This allows us to determine, better than ancient shamans could, precisely how to produce an effective and safe dose from the botanicals in question. For example, we know that peyote cacti are rich in mescaline, among other things, and we know what dosage of mescaline produces a strong psychoactive effect. Thus, we can avoid the unpleasant bitterness of the peyote brew and the associated vomiting, if we so choose, and we can manage dosing safely by ingesting mescaline directly. Again, we know that the psilocybin mushroom's active ingredient is psilocybin, though there are also a few other psychoactive tryptamines involved. Psilocybin is broken down during ingestion into the psychoactive alkaloid psilocin, which is structurally similar to serotonin and probably affects serotonin receptors in brain synapses. With regard to ayahuasca, we know that the main psychoactive ingredient is N,N-dimethyltryptamine, or DMT, much easier to remember. This small psychoactive chemical is broken down very quickly by monoamine oxidase, or MAO. So DMT has to be ingested along with MAO inhibitors, MAOIs, in order to ensure that DMT has an effect on the brain. That's what we know, that the ancient shamans didn't. Unregulated use of these psychoactive chemicals can be dangerous, which is why governments ban most of them. But religious groups have successfully argued that ingesting traditional brews made from the plants themselves should not be illegal, and by and large, the courts have upheld that argument. So much for botanical techniques. What about psychosocial techniques? For a long time, human beings have instinctively understood that rhythmic music and movement in a tight-knit group context can be hypnotic, inducing susceptibility to suggestion and surrender to dissociative states. These experiences can liberate us from tired conventions. They can bond us closely to others. They can catalyze commitment and courage before a battle. They can stimulate bodily changes that alter the conditions for mental and physical health. They can render people psychologically fragile. They can dramatically change beliefs and behaviours. In our time, it is not only rock music concert designers and nightclub planners that know about this. Most rapidly growing religious movements make use of such techniques to facilitate conversion to a favoured religious outlook. These psychosocial techniques are rarely deployed in religious contexts, specifically with the aim of cynical manipulation. Typically, religious leaders believe in the spiritual significance of those experiences at least as much as the participants do. It seems crucial for everyone involved to be able to attribute the spiritual experiences that occur in those settings to the work of spiritual powers of enlightenment or supernatural agents. For example, we sing repetitive songs while swaying and holding hands. Why? Well, not to induce semi-hypnotic suggestibility, even though that happens, but to worship God. That's the reason we give. We dance around flickering firelight. Why? And again, not to induce semi-hypnotic susceptibility, but to summon the spirits. The music and the hand-holding and the swaying, the rhythmic dancing and the flickering lights, they're represented not as causes of spiritual experiences, but as the tools of supernatural powers. Not understanding how embodied human brains work in group settings conjures a veil of mystery around those experiences, and that puts a lot of power in the hands of spiritual leaders. Such psychosocial techniques are unquestionably effective, but they can be made much more effective through careful research and by customizing sensory experiences to individual backgrounds and brains. After all, as you know from your own experience, rhythms and lights and music and togetherness are coarse tools in the way they're usually deployed. Loud noises are painful to some people. Rhythmic movement doesn't work well for people with arthritis. Flashing lights make some people nauseous. Some people get anxious in crowds. We don't currently know how to detect the precise kinds of rhythms and lights and social settings that work best to alter the state of consciousness for each individual. And asking them doesn't help much because they're not inclined to be completely frank, or they may not even know the path towards an altered state of consciousness for them. But it is conceivable that sensory conditions most likely to render someone susceptible to suggestion will be understood much more clearly in the future. After that, a blood test, a brain scan, and a quick psychological survey might disclose the individual variations relevant to optimizing environmental factors in order to produce desired, planned, altered states of consciousness. The result might be something like this. Imagine a socially and emotionally intense religious gathering 50 years from now. Something like a Billy Graham crusade or an evening with the Dalai Lama, but with a twist. The advertising describes the event as a customized spiritual experience in a diverse group of loving fellow travelers, more realistic than holodeck theatres and more meaningful than coarse forms of human togetherness such as live sporting events and music concerts. Upon entering, each person signs an informed consent document and is quickly analysed using a microscopic drop of blood, a non-invasive brain scan, and a short survey. These non-invasive and painless procedures happen in mere seconds, and the analysis allows a program to set optimal sensory parameters and physical location within the auditorium. The guest then moves to an assigned high-tech seat that is automatically programmed with the customised settings. The location of the seat, its unobtrusive sensory equipment, adapt the experience of the event to the individual's specific psychological profile. The result is an individually customized social experience. It takes full advantage of whatever capacity for suggestiveness, learning styles, and neurological distinctiveness exist in each individual. In this environment, the music, the public addresses, the lighting, the surroundings produce an optimally potent experience. People leave the event stronger than ever in their spiritual beliefs, confident in their moral orientation, happier, healthier, determined to live more wholesomely, more compassionately. They came understanding the technology involved and hoping that this would happen. They willingly played the exorbitant entrance fee to support this important event and to make use of the technology for their own purposes. And they returned home satisfied, inspired, and grateful. Now, at this point, we should also pause to consider the possibilities for abuse of such technologies. Abuses can arise in the transition period when some people understand technologies and others do not. Differential understanding creates opportunities for economic and political exploitation. For example, people may not know that the organisers of a social event or the promoters of subliminal message advertising are trying to influence their thoughts and behaviour. In due course, however, presumably most people would know how these technologies work and would accept them and their regulation as ordinary parts of life. Abuses can also arise even when everyone knows how things work. Even when technologies of spiritual experience are deployed as means of explicit social control, in that case, a host of miserable scenarios arises, some of which are depicted in dystopian novels, such as Aldous Huxley's Brave New World or George Orwell's 1984. We are right to worry about mind control because it is a reflexive temptation to which those seeking to gain and protect power easily fall prey. Such control can be enhanced using customized psychosocial technologies. The dystopias that could result from this go beyond even what Huxley and Orwell imagined in their disturbing futurist nightmares. So pros and cons with just about everything I'll be talking about today. Next, meditative techniques. Some individuals can deploy thoughts, actions, postures, foods, surroundings in various combinations with concentration or focused attention or relaxation to induce altered states of consciousness. Some of these states provoke changes in behaviour, mood, physical and mental health. Some are so illuminating and moving that they are said to have profound spiritual significance. Meditative techniques that proved to be widely effective were shared, practiced, refined, and encoded in traditions. Despite extensive research into meditation, there are numerous open questions. What varied effects on consciousness can different types of meditation produce? What are the biochemical triggers and accompaniments of those effects? What key brain regions and functions are implicated in particular meditation effects? The comparative meditation database linking techniques and consciousness effects is far less developed than the botanical database I mentioned earlier linking plants with consciousness effects, but it is being built. Meanwhile, another database linking meditation styles to neurochemistry and neural activation sites is also being elaborated. Before long, the following scenario will be possible. Imagine in a few decades coming across a web advertisement for biofeedback enhanced meditation experiences. You know that biofeedback has been used in stress management, lie detection, and pain management. But the ad explains that a wealth of information about the physiological conditions and effects of meditation now make possible a new type of biofeedback that reduces the time required to master a meditation technique from decades to hours. The ad points out that traditional meditation practitioners have been protesting this turn of events, claiming that a decades-long cultivation of a meditation skill is the only authentic approach. But the ad likens that attitude to a refusal to fly across oceans in airplanes in favour of the traditional method of rowing. The traditional meditation student is immediately lost in the forests of the mind with almost no relevant guidance. Almost all are confined forever to the domain of low-level changes in consciousness, and only a few lucky students manage to get very far, thanks to inbuilt feedback mechanisms that allow them to make purposeful modifications of direction during meditation. But now, the ad insists, you can have the same benefits as those special brains offer their lucky hosts. Through the miracle of biofeedback joined with advancing knowledge of the physiology of meditation, you too can use externally generated information about the state of your embodied mind, information that you cannot produce internally, to guide your meditation practice. The ad invites you to think of regularly visiting a biofeedback meditation location near you in the same way that you think of going to the gym. Both are about fitness, after all. When you arrive for the first time, you'll be asked to select one of 24 meditation styles, each of which is associated with particular biochemical and neurological characteristics, and also with typical emotional and behavioural outcomes. Expert counsellors will be on hand to help you make this vital decision. Once you know what you want, you will be situated in a beautiful and comfortable location where non-invasive equipment is used to produce the relevant biofeedback. Your task is then to deploy the biofeedback information with the aim of training your mind to produce the target state of consciousness. You will have to work hard, just like every student of meditation, but you will be no longer guessing about what works, constantly overwhelmed with frustration. At last, you can have the information you need to make the most of your brain's ability to produce transformative states of consciousness. Think about that one. That one's already here. I've got friends who are doing biofeedback meditation. It's already here. not as sophisticated as I just described it, but it's already here. So resuming the talk, I have sketched the past, the present, and the future of familiar technologies of spiritual experiences in the botanical, psychosocial, and meditative domains. But new technologies offer unprecedented levels of control over states of consciousness, pointedly challenging traditional understandings of the meaning and value of spiritual experiences. Let's start with neuropsychopharmacology, which studies the way chemicals impact our brains, with consequences for experiences and behaviours. The human brain, like other animal brains, uses electrochemical signalling. A wide variety of chemicals known as neurotransmitters operate at synapses, which are intricately organised chemical transmission regions that allow neurons to signal to one another. Neurotransmitter activity can be affected in several ways based on the neurochemistry of transmitter release, reception, and reuptake. So here are five of the most common methods with examples related specifically to entheogens. First, a neurochemical can stimulate the release of a neurotransmitter from an axon terminal. This happens with MDMA or ecstasy, which prompts the release of the neurotransmitter serotonin. Second, an alien chemical can dock with receptors, thereby simulating a neurotransmitter's functions. That happens with DMT, mescaline, and psilocybin, all mentioned above, and also with LSD. Each of these chemicals simulates the effects of the neurotransmitter serotonin. Third, a neurochemical can inhibit the breakdown of a neurotransmitter, thereby allowing it to remain active. This happens with MAO inhibitors, which I also mentioned. They prevent the breakdown of monoamine transmitters, as well as neurochemicals such as DMT, thereby enhancing DMT's effects on the serotonin system. Fourth, a neurochemical can block receptors in several different ways so that the appropriate neurotransmitter function cannot be performed and signalling is suppressed. This happens with PCP, which docks with receptors for the neurotransmitter MDMA and prevents MDMA circuits from functioning. Fifth and finally, a neurochemical can inhibit the reuptake pumps on the axon, thereby leaving the corresponding neurotransmitters active within the synapse for longer than would otherwise be the case. This happens with SSRIs, or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, a common antidepressant. SSRIs prevent the reuptake of serotonin and thus leave it active within the synapse, where it can change mood and sometimes produce entheogenic effects, depending on dosing. The brain maintains a strong defense against the many and varied chemicals in the bloodstream. This defense is called the blood-brain barrier and consists of tightly packed cells in capillaries within the brain. The system effectively blocks most chemicals, only allowing those for which there are specific transport mechanisms to get across into the brain. Of course, some small molecules can diffuse into the brain despite the blood-brain barrier's defenses. But most need an invitation. The blood-brain barrier poses problems for administering psychotropic substances, including those with entheogenic effects. That's partly why research on this subject has been so complicated. But new techniques using nanotechnology are promising to make the blood-brain barrier traversable more or less at will. This may be one of the most important transformations in the neuropsychopharmacological technology of entheogens. Already at this point, neuropsychopharmacologists know which chemicals both enhance and suppress many neurochemical systems by virtue of operating on those receptors and neurotransmitters, those and others that I mentioned and others as well. They have some grasp of the dangers also, including addiction, modification of synaptic receptor density, and structural damage to the brain. It is not for nothing that many psychotropic substances are illegal to possess or consume. Most importantly, experts have a lot of information about what kinds of effects can be expected from modifying neurotransmitter functions. Though we are not there yet, it is not stretching credulity to imagine a meaningful menu of psychoactive substances directly productive of a variety of specific types of spiritual experiences. Something like the near-future neuropsychopharmacological equivalent of the Chinese herbalist, with intriguing shells of substances and a lifetime of accrued wisdom to advise you on the right substance to ingest. Some neuroscientists have argued that simulating the brain using targeted magnetic fields from outside the skull might be able to induce specific types of spiritual experiences, including the feeling of an invisible presence. Controversy surrounds this research, but it has already yielded campaigns to market helmets, like motorcycle helmets with magnets built in. One's called the Koran helmet and another one the Shakti helmet, to eager spiritual cybernauts. Presumably, transcranial brain stimulation will gradually be more deeply understood and could eventually become more precise and powerful. This represents a brave new world of technology, going far beyond the scalp massages and clubs to the head that have defined the state of the art in transcranial brain influence for millennia. What might happen to psychotherapy in the future? Picture a new breed of spiritual therapist 20 years from now. This new type of specialist blends the analytical insight of the psychotherapist, the prescribing authority of the psychiatrist, and the spiritual sensitivity of the traditional spiritual director. Let us call this person a neurospiritual director. Neurospiritual directors can advise clients to make use of neuro-customized psychosocial experiences or to explore biofeedback meditation exercises as depicted above. They might recommend magnetic brain stimulation therapy or conventional psychotherapy. For example, a client presents with difficulties trusting and cooperating with others. This problem is devastating, leaving the client feeling lonely and spiritually empty. The neurospiritual director diagnoses the problem as a persistent inability to achieve a normal level of empathy. She prescribes a course of low-dose empathogens, such as MDMA derivatives or oxytocin nasal sprays, that are well-suited to compensate for natural difficulties with empathy and to stimulate awareness of the degree to which most people normally feel empathically attached to others. The memories of those empathic experiences can then be supported by a suitable empathy-enhancing meditation regime. Both can be used within a therapeutic process permanently to produce behaviour changes toward realising the client's goal of greater empathy and social connectedness. Alternatively, a client presents as spiritually tone deaf, firmly believing that the doors of his spiritual perception capabilities are locked shut. The neurospiritual director might prescribe low doses of an entheogenic hallucinogen, not one that makes your life impractical with visions and auditions bearing no relation to experience, but rather one that enhances the emotional richness and perceptual texture of ordinary experience. The experiences from this short course would be accompanied by intensive therapeutic discussions of the significance of seeing ordinary experience in a more intense way. Biofeedback-guided meditation exercises will then make this richer type of experience a more consistent part of the client's everyday life. And with that, we come to the conclusion. Are you excited, baffled, scared? We've been looking ahead to an era when the biological and psychosocial mechanisms of spiritual experiences are well understood, but it's important to know that all of these future projections are already partly with us. To some extent, from the biofeedback meditation training that I already mentioned, to nasally administered oxytocin in empathy research studies, people are already doing most of these things to some degree. Thus, we need to reflect on the ethical criteria that matter to us when we decide questions of meaning and value, questions of authenticity and reliability. So I close with five very brief thoughts about this. First, affirming the meaning and value of spiritual experiences is often silently dependent on ignorance of their neural and psychosocial workings. Many of these affirmations have relied on supernatural accounts of the origins of spiritual experiences. When we discover the technologies that allow us to start, stop, and regulate such experiences, we naturally wonder why we still need hypotheses about supernatural causes and mechanisms. To the extent that we assign meaning and value to spiritual experiences based on their putative, supernatural origins, we may wind up feeling foolish and conclude that they have no value after all. The lesson here is that we should reject interpretations of the meaning and value of spiritual experiences that are going to make us uncomfortable when we eventually discover how they work. Second, knowing the mechanisms of spiritual experiences need not interfere with people's willingness to appreciate them in a rationally responsible way. This is true even when we deploy technologies to trigger such spiritual experiences. The analogy here is with wonderful food and glorious music of the sort that we heard earlier. They are evolutionary side effects of our neurological makeup. We weren't selected by evolution to appreciate restaurants. Spiritual experiences might be similar, side effects of a big brain cognitive system that are nonetheless beautiful and valuable. Third, it is common for people to report a mystical experience and to attach enormous significance to the fact that it struck them from out of nowhere, completely unexpectedly. This link between spontaneity and meaningfulness usually masks ignorance of biological and psychosocial causes, and thus we must refuse to uphold it. If we cannot attach meaning and value to spiritual experiences that we ourselves induce and cultivate in any of the ways I've described, then we shouldn't attempt to attach meaning and value to such experiences based on their apparent spontaneity. Fourth, the more mechanisms of spiritual experiences are understood, the more judgments of their meaning and authenticity must depend on behavioural effects rather than supposed causes. This is a case of by their fruits shall you know them. No matter how spiritual experiences come to us, what they produce in our lives and in our social environment is what matters most. Fifth and finally, the brave new world of technologized and regulated spiritual experiences should not be an occasion solely for alarm and anxiety. Some of the scenarios I have presented show the ways in which technologies of spiritual experiences might be welcome and helpful, even exciting and engaging. There are serious risks, obviously, but that's true of every era, commensurate with the types and sophistication of technology in existence at the time. The key to striking a healthy balance between wariness and enthusiasm is to welcome self-knowledge. Are we willing to draw aside the veil of ignorance covering the neural embodiment and social embedding of spiritual experiences? Are we open to understanding ourselves as we truly are, wondrous embodied brains equipped to perceive both reality's sense-accessible features and its intricate, spiritually potent valuational depths? If so, along with valid concerns, we have reason cautiously to welcome a future of spiritual technologies. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Wesley Wildman. This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have some time for questions from the audience, and while the ushers are collecting them, let me begin by asking this one. It seems that the natural pace or the rhythm of a spiritual experience is slow to medium, but technology oftentimes tends to be fast. It also seems that the sort of the natural view of spirituality tends to be a vertical view. People look up, you know, they talk about a higher being. And yet technology is often about connection, which tends to be more horizontal. So what is it that science can teach us about these differences and how we can broach them in a more effective way?
It takes a long time to build habits. Habits, bad habits and good habits, they both need to be trained into us. Spirituality is about the building of habits. That's why the pace of spirituality is normally slow to medium. The brain needs to be modified, literally, needs to be modified. Synaptic connections need to be formed. It's plastic, it can be modified, but you need to work on it, particularly when you're young. You can change more quickly, but at any age, neuroplasticity permits change. Now, what this technology does, it can't speed up the change of brain, the formation of habits, but it can facilitate, make more effective, make more efficient the formation of those habits. And in particular, if you have a sudden experience, even without any help from technology, the outworkings of that experience may take decades. A near-death experience can transform your life overnight for some people in one way, but it still has to work its way out in your behaviour and new habits and so on. In the same way, if you use technology to induce a particular sudden experience, it still takes a long time to work itself out. So I think what it does is increases efficiency and takes away the veil of mystery, but it doesn't necessarily change any of the fundamental realities of spiritual experience.
So in a future of technologically assisted spiritual experiences, what kind of training will ministers and priests and monks require in the future?
For one thing, they're going to have to know about this stuff. Currently, there's no one in seminaries teaching seminary students this type of information. They don't know that there is already biofeedback meditation practice. They don't know what near-death experiences are. All of these things are something like mysteries that happen on the edge, but not central to their education. So I think the most central thing that needs to happen is there need to be courses in seminaries in which students are introduced to this material and given the sorts of ethical training of the sort that I indicated in the five concluding points. I think that would go a long way to helping. Last thing to say about that, in any kind of religious professional training process, there's always much more to train people in than you've got time to do. So you couldn't probably have an entire course on this thing. What you need practically is a section of a pastoral theology class or a pastoral care class or something. That's quite common across religious traditions. That's where you need to put it. You need a 2-week block on this material in those classes.
Is there any qualitative difference between religious experiences produced by pharmaceuticals and those produced by spiritual practice?
This is incredibly hotly contested, this question. There is a secret church based in Boston that uses LSD as its sacrament. It's a Christian church, but instead of using bread and wine, it uses LSD. It's illegal to do this, of course, so it's secret. But I've met some of them over dinner, and they tell me that the quality of the experience is much, much more powerful. They feel more connected, their spiritual life is more advanced, they're better Christians and so forth. They would argue one side of the case. But the other people on the other side would say, if you're relying on those kinds of shortcuts, what you're actually doing is cheating yourself of the disciplined processes that you need to produce long-standing changes. I think that debate can be reconciled along the lines of the answer I gave to your question earlier, that you can't replace the cultivation of habits using these technologies, but you can use the technologies to make the cultivation of those habits more efficient.
So let me ask you more directly and personally. Would you support your children if they came to you and said, we wanted to use drugs for a spiritual experience?
You say that as if it's a hypothetical question. I've actually had some practice with this. I have a mixed attitude because I know the downside, the brain damage side, the modification of synapse densities, receptor densities and synapses, the possibilities of changing levels of sensitivity, which can be quite damaging. I say what you need to do is to get fully informed before you try these sorts of things. You need to know what the downsides are. For example, at that dinner, talking to those LSD-ingesting Christians, I was pretty sure that they were suffering long-term brain damage. Seriously? Not a joke. This is really tragic. These people are pursuing their spiritual quest, but in the process, they are interfering with their ability to communicate clearly and lucidly, even when they're not high. So there are real serious downsides to this. So I would say get totally informed before you start trying to do this. It's not for nothing that these things are illegal.
Do you predict that some of the therapies you've mentioned could mitigate anxiety or depression or have impact on sociopathology or other kinds of issues or mental health issues, extreme cases, things like that?
Was the question whether these techniques might help or might worsen?
Help.
Yeah, I do think that's possible. I think what these techniques do is put into the hands of well-trained therapists a range of other options that they don't currently have. Talk therapy is famously difficult to evaluate. That's why there's a huge fight in the therapy industry between cognitive behavioural therapists on the one hand and talk therapists on the other hand. Talk therapy say it's the only way to really connect with people to make long-term change. The behavioural cognitive people say you're just talking, all the time talking, taking people's money and nothing ever changes. Stop talking, give them something that makes a difference. What I think that fight is a version of the same fight that we're going to have around deploying these kinds of technologies to help people. It's going to have to be a balance. And in the examples I gave you balances between talking and more direct forms of intervention. And I think that's the right way to strike the balance, both right now and in the future when these technologies are more prevalent.
Could some of this lead to DNA profiling of the spiritually gifted? And on the other side, could it lead to some consequences also in DNA profiling?
I believe that's ahead of us anyway. It's happening right now. There are laws now on the books trying to protect people from the consequences of medical insurance companies profiling your DNA. You can get your DNA profiled for $1,000 to find out what diseases you can expect to get. There's, again, serious, it's not a joke. This is all happening very quickly. Now, think of your typical Buddhist monastery. You've got a layered approach. You think of it as an egalitarian place. It's definitely not. People start out training in meditation. Only a few people are any good at it. Everyone else serves them. They make the food and whatnot. And then the people who graduate to the next level, they keep practicing. And at each level, people fail to proceed. So at the top, you've only got a handful of very, very serious people. And everyone else, sort of through the training process, fell away. Why did they fall away? Because they didn't have the right kinds of inbuilt feedback processes that allow them to make the most of their neural capacity. So they didn't have the right kind of neural connectivity in the beginning to experience those things. Now, if it turns out that we can do brain scans and discover exactly the same kind of thing, we will have a rapid form of profiling that matches exactly what Buddhist monasteries do over decades. So it won't change the profiling problem. What it will do is make it fast.
So I'm going to be paraphrasing something I remember from Einstein, who said, I think, something along the line of, all that matters can't be measured, and everything that's measured doesn't matter. So how do you as a scientist leave room for matters of faith, the unseen, and belief, and things that have a more spiritual faith-based notion of prayer and the sort of the unseen hand of God?
I take extremely seriously both sides. The unseen, the unassimilable, the immeasurable. For example, I think that ultimate reality passes human comprehension. Not just our human comprehension, but actually the cognitive grasp of any possible creature. So I'm an apophatic mystical philosopher. So take that very seriously. On the other hand, I also know what science can do. And what science can do keeps changing. So what I would do if I were with Einstein, I'd fight with him over the sharp black and white character of his distinction. What I think we're discovering is a kind of merging between spiritual meaning, non-reductive, seriously taken, transformative in its power, spiritual meaning, and understanding from the sciences that allows us to make predictions and control. That's the sort of world that's coming our way. And if we keep holding to a black and white contrast between meaning and measuring, We will never come to grips with this world that's already partly here. We need to have a more sophisticated, less defensive form of spiritual openness to science and to scientific discoveries in order to be able to navigate this future.
Watching some of the recent political rallies, it seems they're employing the few word slogans to almost mimic a chant like agreement. What is your view on this?
Well, politicians know what everyone in the business of communication knows, that human beings are cognitively built with certain preset capabilities and preferences. We like short sayings. We like memorable stories. We like counterintuitive stories. So we'd like superheroes, cartoon characters, who are like human beings in most respects, but maybe just one thing's different, like they're invisible. Everything else is the same. That type of counterintuitive narrative is easy to remember. In the same, that's why religions use those counterintuitive narratives all the time. Politicians use the nugget phrase. Easy to remember. It's actually crafted so that it rolls off the tongue in a pleasing way if you say it yourself personally. And so what's happening there is that people are taking advantage of evolutionarily stabilized cognitive defaults in human beings. You're being played that way every single time you watch an advertisement on television. The research that goes into making those advertising pieces on television or on the radio, those advertising studies, there are thousands of them. They study the cognitive the way we work cognitively, the way we know, the way we remember, the way our behaviour gets affected, and they design advertising campaigns based on that research. They're not guessing about what works. Thousands of studies are backing all of this stuff up. The entire world is trying to take advantage of your cognitive presets. Politicians, advertisers, religions, spouses, children. We've been doing it for thousands of years. It's just that now we know more precisely how it works. Politicians also research what phrases work before they start using them in public.
What have been your own experiences with the techniques that you've described?
Well, I've listened to my children. I don't have a lot of experience. I'm a straight edge person. I don't know if you know what that is, but a straight edge person is someone who doesn't use stimulants or depressants, no alcohol, no caffeine, tries to avoid medication as much as possible. That straight edge lifestyle is a part of my commitment to try and come to terms with the mystery of this world using the apparatus I was born with. It's a kind of a gamble. So I don't drink, I don't smoke pot, I don't drink tea. And so my experience on that front is very limited. My experience on the psychosocial front is pretty extensive because I've been involved in lots of groups that have done that, and I've studied groups that have used those techniques. People who want to convert you will always want to have moving lights, loud music, rhythm, and most importantly, loving environment where you feel accepted in a way that your friends and your family never could. Almost guaranteed to produce conversions. So I've been involved in those things, I've watched those things, I've analysed these things and so forth. So my personal experience is limited in some areas and more extensive in others.
We have time for one last question. In what ways has your native land of Australia and its Indigenous people influenced your work?
Well, that's a double question, isn't it? There's two kinds of influence, one having to do with Australia and the other having to do with its Indigenous people. Australians tend to be cynical, very suspicious, always ready to discover that they're being taken advantage of by some colonial power or another, which has, of course, happened to Australians forever. It's still a colonial power. So I'm always ready to see the sorts of exploitation possibilities in the technologies I'm talking about. And the examples I've given you of the way people are constantly trying to take advantage of you, I think expresses my Australian character pretty neatly. With regard to its Indigenous people, I have an Aboriginal brother. Grew up with him, and he was like a god to me as I grew up. But he's just a regular Aboriginal fellow, except that because of him, I've been able to connect to Aboriginal cultures in some ways and to some degrees, and have actually really been honoured to understand what it means to be a Stone Age type of culture living in a modern world. And as a result, I've become more sensitive to the way that these sorts of techniques that I'm describing have always been used in the long run of human history, and how new techniques can be so disruptive. For example, the introduction of alcohol to Aboriginals was incredibly destructive. It almost wiped out many of them, just like the cold virus wiped out many of them. But it destroyed a lot of their interest in learning their native culture, so the cultures die. Well, what's alcohol? It's a mind-altering substance. Injected at the wrong time with people who don't know how it works, who don't know how to control it, exploited by other people who just want to make money, you can destroy entire spiritual cultures. So I think what that does is drive home for me the special responsibility we've got not to deny this stuff, not to just turn our backs on it, pretend it's not there, but to take it with great seriousness, to take responsibility for it, and to deploy it with care.
Thank you again, Dr. Wesley Wildman, for sharing your time and your thoughts with us. For more information on Dr. Wildman's work and the intersection between science, religion, and spirituality, I encourage you to go to scienceonreligion.org. You've been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org or by writing the Monadnock Summer Lyceum Committee, 25 Main Street, Peterborough, New Hampshire, 03458. The program next Sunday will feature Elizabeth Rice, who will be speaking about the Salem witchcraft trials. And it will also be the last of the season. Finally, I'd like to give a thank you to the Little River Bed and Breakfast in Peterborough, New Hampshire, for hosting Dr. Wildman and his wife for the last few days.